Hello and welcome to the We're Not Experts History podcast. My name is James, and you're about to listen to the third and final instalment in our groundbreaking and, I assume, award-winning trilogy about the Industrial Revolution. So, no pressure. And with me today, as usual, is Sarah. Hello.
Hello. And we all know that when there's a trilogy, the third one is always the worst out of the lot. So, I don't feel any pressure to make this any good. Just so you know.
Thank you.
So, with that out of the way, no, we could just call it, you know, and just it's too hot to be doing this. I can open my window again.
Go for it.
But just a disclaimer, there is somebody drilling outside, not literally outside my window, but just across the street. I'm hoping the window will block it out, but if you do hear any weird background sounds, I apologise for that. Just putting that out there.
Amateur-y.
Huh? No. But at least if you point out how amateur you are, then people might forgive you for it.
I don't think we need to point it out.
No, we don't actually. Right, I've just wasted like 5 whole minutes talking about that. Okay, I'm going to stop and just talk about what I'm supposed to be talking about. The Industrial Revolution. Or more specifically, after the Industrial Revolution. The aftermath. Because if you have tuned in to the last two episodes, the first one, obviously, we talked about, or I talked about, life before, which was farms and more farms and lots of mud. And then we talked about, in the last episode, what happened during, and I won't go over everything again, but basically a whole bunch of stuff happened. Lots of inventions, you had your trains coming in and you had your factories, and just go listen to it. If you haven't listened to it already, go listen to it and then you'll know what I'm talking about now. Or you might not, but anyway. So yeah, all this stuff has happened. So now the smoke is clearing a bit. We've got our steam engines chugging and life is changing very fast. Things are moving. So my aim for this episode is to explore how all these factories and inventions, they didn't just transform the industries, they shook up everyday life. So everyone's feeling this, all these changes. Yeah. Lots and lots of things are happening. So if we look at first social and economic changes, urbanisation is a big one. And following the Industrial Revolution, Britain basically invented the concept of cramming everyone into one place and hoping for the best. And if you look at our previous history with at least 2 devastating plagues and 1 major fire, we know that this isn't the best way forward, but it was unavoidable because you've got factories popping up everywhere, and all of a sudden people that have always worked in the fields because there was no other option, they're flocking to the towns and cities looking for work. And even your sleepy villages, some of them stay as sleepy villages and some still are sleepy villages even today, but some were turning into urban jungles. Like, a lot was happening.
Yeah.
So they started to throw houses up in a hurry, often with more enthusiasm than plumbing. And,
lovely.
Yes. And, you know, you've got to imagine as well, I mean, you might have a family of 5 living in a 2-bedroomed house and you think, oh, God, there's no room. But back then you had families, entire families, and they were big families. They would squeeze into one room. Because they needed to get as many people into the space as possible. So it was very noisy, it was very smelly, and it was essentially the birth of modern city life. So welcome to urbanisation, everyone.
Oh, how times have changed.
Yeah.
I've been houses quicker.
Yeah, now they're doing that, what's it called? You know, the micro apartments. So it's kind of like going backwards now, isn't it? Where, you know, you get a tiny little square of space and you have to try and live in it. I mean, granted, because I've watched a lot of these on YouTube because I find them really fascinating, but you generally only have one person if you did a micro apartment, but not a whole family. But anyway. So these changes, they were seen countrywide, but just a few examples of cities that either sprung up or rapidly expanded thanks to the Industrial Revolution. So you've got Manchester. Yep. So that's like the ultimate poster child of the Industrial Revolution. It was once a modest market town. And once the cotton industry kicked off, Manchester just exploded. And it was absolutely crammed with mills and lots of smoke and pigeons and... It just blew up, not literally blew up, but you know what I mean. You've got Birmingham. That was known as the workshop of the world. So Birmingham was a hot spot for your metalwork and your gadgets and things with too many cogs. Kind of like the steampunk capital before steampunk was even a thing.
I don't even know what they.
We'll talk about that after. Sheffield, that was famous for its cutlery and steel. Sheffield went from a very sleepy town or village to, well, quite busy in no time. And if it could be forged or hammered or polished, chances are it came from Sheffield. Leeds was another textile giant, so they were absolutely buzzing with wool and cloth production. So those itchy trousers that your great 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 grandfather wore, they probably came from Leeds. In case you were wondering. And Glasgow, Scotland's industrial powerhouse, and they were building ships and trains and a whole lot of stuff. So they embraced the age of iron and steam. So with all of this going on, people are pouring into these cities, and there was a bit of a mad scramble to put roofs over their heads, and the motto was build first, ask questions later. So the result was you got your rows and rows of your terraced houses, a bit like dominoes made of brick. And they were all squashed together with not a lot of space, lots of character, and maybe a shared loo out the back if you were lucky. So they were known as back-to-back houses because they were just in just rows. There were just rows and rows and rows of them. And at best, you could describe them as cosy. You normally had one room downstairs and one upstairs, if you were lucky enough to have one to yourself, and neighbours on either side. So privacy, that was a distant dream. Personal space, forget it, not happening.
At least one of us is old enough to remember those in certain areas of East London before they were all torn down and replaced.
Yeah, think...
I remember seeing them.
Yeah, I mean... I don't know if they are very familiar. I can picture them very clearly, but whether it's because I've seen them with my own eyes or because I've seen them on the TV, I'm not actually sure. But yeah, I can visualize what they look like.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're a lot from East London. They probably lived in these.
Well, yeah, my grandparents, they moved out of East London into Dagenham back in the 50s. And yeah, they would have moved from, because when they were clearing the areas, my grandparents obviously were moved out into the suburbs. So yeah, it would have been where they would have been living. So another type of housing that the revolution saw a rise to was courtyard housing. So you've got your terraced and then you've got your courtyard housing, and this is where you've got multiple families. They would live around a small shared yard, and I've actually seen, I can't remember where we were, but I've got to think, we went somewhere on holiday, I think it might have been Somerset, And there was a small village just up the road from where we stayed. And it was very, very old. And yeah, it even had, it had like the courtyard housing. And you could even, and what really fascinated me as well, I don't know how old these houses were, but you could even see what would have been stables. Because a lot of people then, that would have been their transport. They would have had a horse or a horse. And so, yeah, I found that really interesting. So, yeah, I've seen that type of housing. Now, if you were really unlucky or you were very new to town, you might have ended up in the slums. So these were kind of like, yeah, the worst of the worst. They were very overcrowded, very poorly built. Not that anything was well built then. Everything was kind of chucked up, a bit like today. Again, we've come full circle, haven't we? But yeah, the slums, they were, as well as being overcrowded and poorly built, they often lacked basics like fresh air and clean water. So really not comfortable.
No. I've read like reports from the time where you might have lived in one of these, but you probably didn't get your own room. It would have been just partitioned off with a bit of rope and a blanket over it. And that was all that was between you and the family next to you.
Yeah, yeah, no, that is true. And even, even if you were lucky enough to have a room just for your family, you still, you got to think, you've got your whole family, you wouldn't have had any privacy at all, even from your own family. You know, mums, dads, all the kids, all sleeping in, and I think what they would do, they would divide the male and female areas off with, like you've said, like rags or curtains. But imagine not being able to slam your bedroom door when you've got the aunt or your mum or something. You just got to go behind your curtain. Yeah.
How are new little slum dwellers made if they're in or partitioned off into male and female sections?
Say that again. Oh, that, well,
how do you make it really new?
That's the thing. It's, yeah, that's probably why kids played out on the streets quite a lot.
Yeah.
You know, just send them out on the street and get cracking making some new ones. That's probably the only opportunity you had. But yeah, so, you know, I think we're quite blessed now with the way we live. So talking of housing, you could say that industrial Britain definitely brought people closer together, but maybe a little bit too close, maybe.
Yeah.
So as well as your houses, so it wasn't just all the chimneys and the cramped houses, you've got your public buildings. And suddenly, because suddenly with all these people, there's a need for this. So you've got your schools, your libraries, and your workhouses, which will be another episode at some point.
Thanks for the warning.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can start making your excuses. I'm washing my hair that day, I can't listen. But yeah, these all suddenly started to spring up. Some were more fun than others. I bet you can guess which ones weren't. Workhouse. Town halls, they popped up. They were very grand and fancy looking places where very serious looking gentlemen could sit around and discuss very serious things, very important things. And I don't know what they were though. And public baths. Yes, probably. Public baths were introduced because, let's face it, things were getting a bit smelly.
I suppose if these people are running these towns, they want the locals to at least have some sort of cleanliness.
Yeah. Well, they don't want a repeat of the plague, do they? Because that weren't good. So, anyway.
Great.
Yeah. So, and of course, as well, you've got the rise of the railway stations. And these were like the cathedrals of steam travel. And you've got museums. So, museums are now a thing. And where your curious Victorians could gawk at fossils and stuffed animals and things. So yeah, quite a lot changing already, just from from that.
Have you been to the Natural History Museum recently?
Yeah, sorry, I got distracted for a minute because I heard banging, but I think that was, I don't know what that was. I have been
That's
to the Natural History.
On the other side of the partition. Oh,
yes,
yeah,
probably.
I found the I found the content disappointing, but the building is spectacular.
Yes, that's I'm like that. We go somewhere, and I just want to look at the building, and I'm just like fascinated looking at how it was built, and I'll be like, oh my god, this has been standing here since when we went to the Red Lion. I mean, that's going way back past this, but the Red Lion in Colchester. Just the fact it's been sat there for all that time, and a lot of it is original as well. The manager actually took me around because, luckily for me, she was just as fascinated by the history as I was, and I think she was actually quite glad to have someone to talk to about it. And she took me around and she pointed out which bits were original and which bits weren't, and it was amazing. It was just so exciting. I spent more time wandering around with the manager than actually in the hotel room itself. But yeah, that was a really cool experience. But what was I talking about? Oh yes, factories. Well, that's what I was going to go on to. The rise of the factory system. So we've covered cities and what was happening there with all the buildings and things. But a big part of why that was happening was the rise of the factory system. So before the Industrial Revolution, and I think I briefly touched on this last time, people were making things the old-fashioned way, by hand, at home, often while balancing a cat or a small child on one knee and a spinning wheel on the other. It was kind of like that kind of setup. Yes, but then along came the factory system and things changed very rapidly. So with the invention of all these clever machines and the power of steam, manufacturers realised instead of dishing out the work to people at home, they could get a lot more done under one big roof. So the factory was born. So factories brought efficiency and mass production and a lot of shouting because it would have been noisy. And they also brought structure to working life. So for the first time, people weren't just fitting in work as and when they could, you know, around the kids' bath times and, you know, around their favourite programmes on the telly. Literally, you had a shift, you had a lunch break. I don't know what lunch breaks are. Do you know what lunch breaks are? Never heard of them.
Yeah, about half an hour.
But do you actually know what they are? Because in all my years as a nurse, I don't think I ever experienced a lunch break. They were like a myth.
All my years of not being a nurse, yes, I do know what they are.
Yeah, you probably took the wiser career choice, to be fair. Oh, and the joys of clocking in and out, which I'm sure we've both experienced. And getting your pay docked an hour if you were 15 minutes late. Rude.
No, we're not.
Sorry?
My lot aren't that bad.
Oh God, mine were. It was, if you were more than 10 minutes late, you might as well just come in an hour later because you weren't going to get paid for that first hour. But anyway.
Maybe you can cover that. Maybe you should do one on the NHS.
Yeah, that would be, but I might leave that out because then it might sound like I'm moaning a bit, which I was, but...
Like you are now.
I am now, yes.
Anyway,
going back to... factories. To be honest, I probably had it much better where I worked than this, because it wasn't all tea and top hats, these factories. It all sounds great, sounds marvellous, all these machines, but the factory system did have a dark side, and I won't go into too much detail about it because that again is another topic I'd like to cover on its own, because it is a topic on its own. There's enough to say, but many workers were seriously exploited, especially in the early days. Long hours, low pay, no health and safety did not exist. It wasn't unusual for people to work 12 to 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, in a noisy, dirty and downright dangerous environment, which kind of sounds like the job I left, thinking about it. Anyway.
Did that work, children?
Sorry?
Did they employ children?
They did, and children got the worst of it. They were often
But not in
hired
the NHS.
because, oh no, not in the NHS, no. No, the factories did. But
Yeah. Oh, okay.
the NHS, no, by that point, child labour was kind of frowned upon. But back then, before the NHS, children were often hired because they were small enough to squeeze between the machines. Particularly in the cotton trade, they used to have to get under the machines and clean out all the fluff and all the bits that gathered on the floor. And bearing in mind, these machines had moving parts and no off button. And these poor kids, they worked for pennies, they got very little, if any, education, and they were lucky to make it home with all their fingers. So in time, these conditions, they did lead to a wave of social change, including the rise of social unions, workers' rights, and the idea that maybe children shouldn't be operating heavy machinery before breakfast.
Possibly.
So every cloud has a silver lining, right? But at the time,
Well, obviously,
it wasn't pleasant.
I think also at the time and for quite a while afterwards, you'd have men and women basically doing very similar jobs, but the women would be paid less.
Yeah, and that, to be
And I
honest, that
think
took a long
sometimes,
time to
yeah,
fill.
that was still going 100 years later. That
Yeah.
I think you'd also, yeah, they were a mother, they were allowed to start an hour later to get the kids off to school and feed the husband.
Yeah, of course, you've got to feed the husband or he gets grumpy.
Yeah. How is Dave?
So moving on to another impact that which you might not seem obvious, but it is when you think about it, environmental impact. You can't
Yeah. Well,
expect to have all of these changes happening without some impact on the environment around you. Air pollution, for one, free soot included with your oxygen. Factories were burning coal like it was going out of fashion, and cities like Manchester and London, for example, and many others, I'm sure, they were constantly engulfed in a thick, greasy smog. This was often described as a pea soup, or as pea soup.
yeah, pea soup, yeah.
So locals just to the locals, it was just the weather. It was like, cor blimey, it's a right pea super out there today. You can imagine. I was going to do a Cockney accent, but I can't do one, so that's not happening.
I thought you were already doing that.
Yeah, no,
When
that
they
wasn't
talk
a Cockney
about
accent.
climate change now and the temperatures, they always talk about it going sort of like, what is it, 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial average. And I'm assuming that when they say that, they mean pre-industrial age because
Yes.
it's the Industrial Revolution that probably kicked it all off.
Well, yeah, and I'll mention that in a moment. Yeah, you just ruined my whole thing. Rude. No, it's fine. It's fine. It's a very valid point. But where was I? Put me off my stride now.
Pollution.
Air pollution. We've got water pollution. Basically, I keep saying basically.
Yeah,
I need to
put them
not
back
say
to
that. Just punch me in the head when I say that, okay? Actually
Oh,
don't,
we're in the
because
same room.
yeah. But rivers become the industrial equivalent of a rubbish bin. So you've got your dye works, your tanneries, and your sewage systems, of all things. They just happily dump their waste into the nearest water source. And
Yeah.
the Thames at one point was so disgusting it could literally peel paint and possibly your eyebrows if you went close enough.
Wow.
And again, I'll just briefly mention it because this might be another episode idea. Please phone in if you'd like to hear this one. But in the summer of 1858, they had what they called the Great Stink, because it was so bad that it was just really bad. I'm not going to go into too much detail about that, but it actually went down in history as the Great Stink because of this.
Yeah.
As well as your air and water pollution, you've got your deforestation, because we need lots of space now for all these factories and housing. Also, we need to we need the fuel. So we're chopping down trees left, right and centre. And the wildlife just had to pack up and leave. So, yeah, that's not great for the woodland creatures. And with the towns springing up so fast and planning not really being a thing, housing was just squashed in wherever it could fit, even if it was sideways. Sanitation was just an afterthought.
Yeah,
I went a bit Essex then. That's probably an insult to Essex people. Apologies, Essex people. Technically, I'm not an Essex person, even though I live in Essex now.
No, you're no technical about it. You're not an Essex person.
I'm not an Essex person. So I'm allowed to say that. Actually, no, I'm not. Right, let's pretend that didn't happen. Okay.
I'm from Essex and I wouldn't say it.
Sorry?
I'm from Essex and I wouldn't say it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm not from Essex, so I'm allowed to say it.
No, and you shouldn't say it.
Well, I did, so... Anyway, before this descends into an argument, what we're talking about? Yes, bad planning. So houses and factories are just being chucked in everywhere, and what was fields and nice scenery is being replaced with soot-covered alleyways and factories, and just not pretty. It's not pretty anymore. It's starting to look ugly. The soil gets contaminated as well, because of all the chemicals, because we've got the chemical industries now kicking off. It's suddenly land that was once abundant in crops suddenly struggles to grow weeds. And the poor farmers, they just had to adapt to this or just move somewhere where their potatoes wouldn't glow in the dark. So not good for farming. And the point you mentioned earlier, climate change.
Yeah.
A gift to the future, essentially. Because of all the excitement, no one gave a thought that all these clouds of carbon that are being released into the sky... no one really thought about it. And 200 years later, it's not just hanging around locally. It's been helping to heat up the entire planet. So whoops, yeah. Big whoops. So although it, in a nutshell, the Industrial Revolution did what it said on the tin and it did revolutionise just about everything, it did come at the expense of the environment, but all in the name of progress.
Yeah, I mean, looking back, obviously, air pollution, water pollution, deforestation, there's still problems now.
Yeah.
We've still got companies pumping crap into rivers.
Oh, yeah, we have. Yeah, most definitely.
Yeah. Terrible. We don't learn.
We don't. Nope. Like I said, we just go full circle. So... moving on to just general culture and daily life. So the revolution didn't just change how things were made. It completely reshaped the rhythm of daily life.
Yeah.
And this was quite an interesting one for me. So before the revolution, most people worked in tune with natural light. So they'd be up at dawn, down with the sun. And in actual fact, most people would have followed what is known as a biphasic sleep pattern, which is where you don't sleep once, you sleep twice. You have two sleeps in a 24-hour period. So nowadays, the common idea is that you go to bed at whatever time, you sleep through, you wake up in the morning. That's normal. Unless you work night shifts or you've got insomnia or whatever, generally, that is what is considered a normal sleep pattern for an adult human. But back way before, or before the Industrial Revolution, and going way back, people would sleep twice, and the normal routine would be to go to take your first sleep at sunset, sleep for a couple of hours, wake up at maybe say 12 ish, and you'd stay awake for maybe 2 to 3 hours. And this period of wakefulness was known as the watch. And during that time, you would do things that you would do during the day. You'd tend to your animals, you might go to church, you might have some quality time with your spouse, which you wouldn't generally have time to do in the day because you'd be working the fields, etc. So then you'd go back to bed and you'd sleep until sunrise. So that was how people slept. And I'm really annoyed at myself because there was a very good book on this, which was, I'll have to look it up. Let me look it up quickly, because I was meant to make a note of it so I could mention it. If it takes me too long to find it, then I'll give up. But where is it? No, I'll have to come back to that. But there is a very good book that was written, and it goes into the whole idea of biphasic sleep in a lot more detail. And I've completely forgotten the author and the title of the book because I'm useless. No, I'll have to come back to that. Anyway.
I thought you were going to argue. I wasn't going to.
What's that?
About you being useless.
Oh, no, I wasn't expecting it, an argument from you.
No,
I know you too well.
We have
met. So, when factories arrived, the mechanical clock became the boss, and people now rose not with the birds but with a 5 a.m. factory bell, and the workday ended when your legs did, or when your boss said it was okay and you could go home.
Wow.
So as I mentioned previously, factory work involved very long, very, very repetitive shifts, often 12 to 16 hours, 6 days a week. Sundays were still sacred. Weekends still didn't exist, not yet. And the day became a very strict cycle of work, eat, collapse, repeat. A bit like now. The idea of fun was postponed until either you retired or maybe the next public hanging or something. But generally, it was a very repetitive cycle.
I'm just wondering, if people listen to this in years to come, we might have to explain what retirement was.
Yeah, because they won't know, will they?
No, it won't be such a thing.
No.
Work till you die.
No, exactly.
Oh, they can look it up.
I came full circle. Meal times became a lot more rigid and rushed, so because now they're working to the clock, so they can't be having their leisurely lunches in the fields. You'd have your bread and tea in a noisy canteen, or maybe some cold potatoes at your workstation if you couldn't get away. Dinner was usually late, after dark, and with cities being so crowded and noisy, sleep was more of a suggestion than a guarantee. So it's no small wonder that over time our sleep cycle become compressed, because we're trying to fit our hours of sleep into a smaller or a shorter amount of time. So eventually the biphasic sleep pattern, it just phased out. And what's curious is one thing I noticed, and this was before I was aware of biphasic sleep even being a thing, but when I did give up my shift work and I went freelance, and for the first time I was keeping my own hours, so I noticed that I naturally fall into a biphasic sleep pattern. I will generally go to sleep, I'll fall asleep maybe, I don't know, 10-11 o'clock, I'll wake up early hours, I'll be awake for a couple of hours, I'll fall back to sleep, and I'll wake up again about maybe 7, and I thought I was having disturbed sleep, and I thought, oh, you know, there's something wrong here. But having looked into it, I realised that I'm probably, my pattern of sleep is probably closer to how humans naturally would have slept before Industrial Revolution got in the way and kind of changed our pattern, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's odd, because I felt like sleeping for the last 35 minutes.
That's just mean. That is just very, that is just uncalled for. I've been entertaining you.
I saw my opportunity and I took it.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, moving on from sleep, otherwise you will, I'll put you to sleep. Family life suffered as well. With parents and children working different shifts, families become more like ships in the night rather than a family unit. So, yeah, a lot of change. So, I mean, I'm not saying that the life before was better or easy, because it wouldn't have been, but you kind of get a sense of the flexible rural lifestyle that people would have had. It has been replaced by this very kind of regimented, clock watching, shift working system, and it would have been very different to what people were used to. Huge changes.
It's hard toil in the fields for pennies, or hard toil in a factory for pennies.
Yeah, without the fresh air. So, as well as, that's moving on to something a little bit more cheerful. Consumer goods. This is where our shopping addiction was born. Before the revolution, buying a shirt or a pair of shoes meant waiting for a local craftsperson to make it. You couldn't just kind of go on Amazon or pop to Tesco or wherever. You had to find a local craftsperson, ask them to make it by hand, and probably remortgage your goat to pay for it, because it wouldn't have been cheap. But now, thanks to these mechanised factories, things like clothes and shoes and textiles, they could be churned out in bulk for the first time. And this made them much cheaper and more accessible.
Yeah.
So suddenly, even working classes could afford to own more than one pair of trousers, which was luxury, absolute luxury to them. It wasn't just clothes. Factories were producing furniture, crockery, soap, candles, other household items on a scale never seen. So this is how we started to get into the whole thing of knickknacks. Because I imagine you probably have, but you know when you go to a museum and they'll have a staged house from, I don't know, 17, whatever, and it always looks so empty. Like, there'll just be like a simple little bed and a table and that's it. There's no stuff, there's no clutter, it's just empty. But this was all changing. Sorry?
You make that sound like a bad thing.
No, I'm not. That's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is now we're addicted to clutter, to stuff. And this is how it was born. No, I'm not actually. I'm very minimalist. But as a nation, we like stuff. And this is where it came from. And even things like for kids, like sweets and toys, and you could get your penny sweets and tin toys and all of these little things. So it wasn't just the posh kids now that had playthings. Your everyday working class could have things. With railways, goods are travelling further and faster than ever before. So even if you lived way out in the sticks, you could actually get hold of fancy urban items that you couldn't have dreamed of before, unless you were willing to take a very long trip into town. And we've also got products from across the empire.
If you live in a country,
Sorry?
If you lived in a country, as I was saying, if you lived in a country, you could get your goods to London, especially if you're growing them, you could get them to London that day while they were still fresh
Yeah,
and make a
exactly.
profit.
Yeah, definitely. No, and that would have been huge. So what was I saying? You've also got goods coming from other countries, not just from the UK. Your spices and your teas and things, they're all coming in from across the continent. And a bit like today though, what's funny is that cheap wasn't always cheerful. Some goods did fall apart after like a week, if that, and dyes were toxic because health and safety wasn't a thing. And you got a lot of imitation goods even back then, including, which is quite disturbing, but including in food. So you could buy more of it because it was imitation, but you might regret it halfway through chewing it, because it wouldn't be what you
Yeah,
thought.
I'm thinking of bread made with brick dust.
Yeah, a lot of that would do in the black, jumping forward a little bit, but the black market during rationing, I think there was a lot of that, wasn't there?
Now, bread wasn't rationed.
No, not bread as such, but on the black market,
But yeah,
they would
tea
have,
made from acorns.
yeah, they would
Yeah.
have been replacing things with things and selling it on the black market, as if it was. But anyway, that's a whole other subject. So yes, the Industrial Revolution was a game changer for consumers, but it did turn us into a nation of shopaholics, which is probably not a good thing. Maybe it's for some, but anyway. So talking of shopping, a leisure activity, leisure and entertainment in general. It took time, but after many laws and reforms, which I'll come to, once people realised they didn't have to spend every waking hour working, they started to discover that fun could be scheduled. Now, this wasn't straight away, as I will explain towards the end, because I left the boring bit for the end.
Oh, blimey.
Yeah, I know, so you still got that to look forward to.
Yeah.
But because initially, like I said, when this first all took off, people were being exploited. They were working all hours that God sent, and anyway. But when things did start to change, and free time did actually start to happen, because the concept of free time never really existed prior to the revolution. You know, you might get a little bit of time here and there in between digging a field or whatever, but you generally didn't have time off. And people started to, I mean, people have always been able to have fun, even when you go back before the revolution, be it through drinking, dancing, kicking a pig's bladder around a field. But with factory work, introducing structured shifts, and eventually the weekend came into existence. People had time off, actual time off, like scheduled time off for the first time. So even working classes could enjoy a day out where they didn't have any obligation to work because it was their day off. So it was a completely new concept. And organised sport became a thing. So your football, cricket, rugby, those things had already existed, as you would know, but they started to form proper clubs and leagues now. And the railways made it easier for people to travel to matches. So you'd actually be able to go and watch your favourite team if they were playing somewhere else and cheer them on. And of course, we mustn't forget the Great British Seaside Holiday. Coastal towns like Blackpool, Brighton, Scarborough, they boomed with like piers and your promenade, Is it promenades? I was going to say promenades.
Promenades.
Is it promenade? I was right the first time. I thought promenades in my head, and I thought it came out as promenades.
Yeah. Promenade sounds like a fizzy fruit drink.
Yeah, it does actually. Like lemonade, but with proms in it. Proms. I don't know what proms are. It's made that up. So for the first time, the working classes actually could catch a break.
Catch a break? What's that mean?
Have a break. How old are you? Catch a break. Have you never heard that term, catch a break?
Is that Americanism?
Probably.
No.
You've got to remember, I have a lot of American friends, okay? And I do pick these things up.
You should be teaching them. They'll never learn otherwise.
No, probably not. But at least they can understand what I'm saying if I get down with the Americans, you know? Mm. Anyway. People have got a little bit more disposable income for the first time. And when I say people, I'm talking about your working classes. Obviously, the rich always had disposable income, but the working classes didn't. You barely would have enough money to eat sometimes. But finally, there's more disposable income. So entertainment venues are multiplied. So music halls, they were like your Netflix of the Victorian era. So they were very cheap, popular, sometimes a bit rude. You could also watch a play, a circus or a travelling show for as little as a few pennies. And with people, it became more common for people to be literate. So people began to read for fun. So you got your penny dreadfuls and your novels, newspapers, magazines. That kept people entertained. Bearing in mind, this is all happening over quite a long period of time. This isn't happening in a matter of weeks. It's all just, you know.
They evolve.
Yes. So, although obviously the revolution's had its more not so good points, you know, pollution and exploitation and all of these things, it did help to create the concept of leisure time, particularly for the working classes. So that was a game changer, because can you imagine if that concept didn't exist now, and things like annual leave and didn't happen? Like, it would be a we wouldn't, we'd be at work right now slaving our guts out. A good thing. Now, another thing that happened that was quite important was the rise of the middle class. Now, before the revolution, society was pretty much split in two almost. You had your wealthy, rich landowners on one side, and you had the working poor, and very little in between.
Yeah.
There would have been, I'm being very black and white here, there would have been in between, but when you kind of looked at the country as a whole, you had your rich and your poor. The rich and poor divide was very, very clear.
The haves and the have-nots.
Sorry?
The haves and the have-nots.
Mm, exactly. But as industry boomed, a whole new breed of people started to pop up. So your factory owners, your merchants, your bankers, your engineers and your professionals. So these, they weren't titled, but they were self-made wealthy people. And with the new money, did you just say new money?
Yeah,
you're exactly right. And with new money came new lifestyles. So the middle classes, they moved into, you know, you see those very neat looking Victorian terraced houses. And I mean, a lot of them now are converted into flats, but a middle class family probably would have had a whole house to themselves. And I tell you what, they are absolutely gorgeous. My husband's uncle, he had a flat in Leon C, and it was a converted Victorian house, and it was only just a one floor, flat is one floor, isn't it? I absolutely loved it. It had the big high ceilings, it had fireplaces in every room. It was an absolute bugger to heat, from what he told me, but absolutely gorgeous. So these would have been the types of houses that these middle-class families would have lived in. So it wasn't the big manor houses.
I can beat that. I know someone who's his father and I think grandmother lived in one of those houses, and they had the house to themselves.
Mm.
And the rooms were huge, high ceilings, gorgeous plasterwork on the ceilings around the light fitting, spectacular.
Do you know what? I mean, my memory is vague and I'd have to ask my parents, but I'm very sure that the first house when we moved to Essex, I'm sure the first house we lived in was a Victorian house. And obviously, as a child, I didn't appreciate it at all. But thinking about it, I kind of vaguely remember it being Victorian style. But yeah, I'd have to ask. And I remember we had an absolutely huge back garden. It was like over 120 feet. It was massive.
Where was this?
In Grays.
Grays, oh.
Yeah, yeah. But what I'll have to do, I'll have to ask my parents if... because when I look back and I see old photos of the street, they do look like Victorian builds. But, you know... And I remember saying to my husband, I would really appreciate living somewhere like that now. But back when you were a kid, it's just the house I didn't fully grow up there. We ended up moving again, but I probably spent I spent a good few years of my life in that house. We moved again when I was 10 or 11, I think. But anyway, but yeah, and that was nice. But anyway, I've completely digressed. But yes. So middle classes, they live in these beautiful houses, and they were the ones who had, you know, all their lace curtains and porcelain figurines, and they even had parlours, so the rooms that nobody went in unless you had a guest. What a waste of a room. And they were very big on self-improvement, so they sent their children to finishing school. They were obsessed with manners and morals. So they pretty much acted like the upper classes, but just without the titles. That's what they were aspiring, and because they had the money, they could do it in a way, you know, they could do a lot of the things that the upper classes could do. Things that wouldn't be accessible to the working class, the middle classes would be able to do, if that makes sense.
I want to say mimic, they try to mimic it, but
yes.
I think what makes them stand out quite a lot is that you tend to find us working classes and the proper upper classes have a lot of the same standards.
Yes.
The family and things like that, whereas the middle class, all they were looking at was being seen as upper class.
Yes, that's true. They didn't kind of, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
So this is the more boring bit, if you're still awake. We had a lot of reform happening during or after, following the revolution. So following the initial boom, there was a lot of reform. So society essentially got a makeover. And the Industrial Revolution, it brought a lot of good things, but it brought a lot of inequality. So I'm thinking of the poor working classes being absolutely put upon on the factories. And then you've got your rich landowners and your rich mill owners absolutely living it up. So very a lot of inequality going on. And people for the first time were actually saying, hang on, is this fair? Don't like this. So this brought about the Reform Acts, and these started in 1832. And they expanded voting rights, so allowing more men, especially the new middle classes, they had a say. Because prior to that, only the certain classes would be allowed to vote. Now the vote is open to everybody, but then it wasn't just not open to women, it wasn't open to all men. Women wouldn't get the vote until 1918, so we're still a way off that.
Only some women got it in 1918.
That is true, but just as
I'm another
yes,
podcast.
Write that down. The rise of the trade unions, they gave workers a collective voice, and workers began to march and give speeches and produce the odd strongly worded pamphlet talking about how unfair everything was. And meanwhile, you've got social reformers, they're pushing for better housing, better sanitation, better working conditions. Big shout out to Lord Shaftesbury and Octavia Hill. I won't go into too much detail, but Lord Shaftesbury?
Well, Shaftesbury to me, because I'm from the south, but I imagine Shaftesbury.
I guess it depends who's pronouncing it, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Anthony Ashley Cooper, he was the 7th Earl of Shaftesbury, and he was a British Tory politician, and he campaigned for better working conditions, reform to lunacy laws, education, and the limitation of child labour. So he did quite a lot. And Octavia Hill, she was a pioneering thinker and a social reformer. So she did a lot of work on improving urban houses and protecting green spaces. So all the lovely open green that we have around us, we've probably got her to thank for it, because otherwise there'd be concrete buildings everywhere.
I'm thinking all the lovely parks in London. I wonder if they're part of her legacy.
Yeah, more than likely. So, big shout out to those folks. There would have been many others, but those two particularly stand out. There were lots and lots of reforms, lots of things happening, but the 1848 Public Health Act, that was Britain's first major attempt to clean up towns. So this involved setting up local health boards and encouraging proper drainage, sewers and clean water. Although at this stage, nothing's mandatory. This is all just suggestions. Then in 1854, the infamous Dr. John Snow, not that John Snow, for those of you who have watched Game of Thrones. He famously linked a cholera outbreak in Soho to a contaminated water pump, proving that water could carry disease, because this hadn't occurred to anybody before this. So he removed the handle from the pump so people couldn't use it, and the cases dropped. Legend. Exactly. And so this led to the 1866 Sanitary Act, and this made it mandatory for local authorities to improve sewage and waste disposal. So they couldn't turn a blind eye or just plug their nose at the overflowing cesspits. And then finally, in 1875, the Public Health Act, that pulled everything together into one comprehensive enforceable law. So they could enforce these rules now. So this kind of paved the way for slum clearances to begin. That was slow, but it was happening. Housing regulations improved. And finally, Britain is turning from a grimy, disease-ridden death trap into something vaguely resembling a functional society, kind of, if you can call it that.
I wonder when they finish.
I don't think they've finished yet. I don't think they will. It took time. It took a lot of time, but eventually sewers were built, clean water flowed, and people developed a new respect for soap. Now, what's interesting is that if you think back to the last major plague, I'm not talking about COVID, I'm talking about the one before that. No, I'm talking about the Great Plague of London. Look how much time has passed before they actually start to really clean up, if you know what I mean. But anyway, at least they got there in the end. We're not far off. Don't worry, we're not far off. Going back to children, we did mention earlier that children were kind of got the brunt of things, being forced to work in quite horrific conditions in the factories. But this did call for reform. And finally, somebody or people are starting to think we need to be educating these kids. We don't just want to be stuffing them up chimneys. So Sunday schools were the first widespread effort to teach working class children to read, mainly the Bible, but still reading. And then the Factory Acts, they came in and they started to limit child labour hours, and it became a requirement that children had to have some schooling, even if they were working. And then by 1870, the Elementary Education Act made school available for all children between the ages of 5 and 13. So not quite Hogwarts, but a good start. And by 1880, education became compulsory. And by 1891, it was free for all kids under 11. So finally,
I'd like to know.
we have some kind of education system.
I believe it still wasn't compulsory in Devon and maybe Cornwall because the children were making so much money making lace. So I
Oh, right.
think they might have still been spending more time making lace into the
Probably.
1930s than they were at
Oh,
Cornwall,
wow.
yeah.
I mean, obviously, when these reforms and acts came in, it wouldn't have been overnight change. Even when you think of registration, it was July 1837, they brought in national registration where births and deaths and marriages had to be formally registered and not just put in the parish record. But it would have took a long time for people to actually get into that kind of notion of registering. And I mean, and I've often found when I've been researching family members or even for other people, and if you've got someone that was kind of born on the cusp, like if somebody was born in like 37 or 38 or even 39, 40, you won't find a registration. You'll find a baptism. And you'll find them on the census, so you know they existed, but you won't find a registration. And you think, oh, they probably just didn't do it. Probably just weren't in the. But anyway. So, yeah, what I'm trying to say is these things, they kind of. They're big changes and they take time. Now, there was a big global impact. I'm not talking about environmental global, I'm talking about generally. Britain lit the fuse. We started it. We kicked it all off. It was all our idea. We're the brains behind the operation. But other countries quickly followed. So Germany, France, the United States, later on Japan. They all jumped on the steam-powered bandwagon. So Europe as a whole saw a massive boom in steel and railways and. The USA, they went for it. They were whacking up huge factories and expanding and just building everything massive. I mean, I don't know if you've been to America, but one thing that does strike you when you go is the sheer size of everything. It is,
People. Oh,
and
yeah.
people,
Yeah.
but it's so big. Everything's just scaled up. It's insane. When we went a couple of years ago and we stayed in a village, it was described as the village of Oak Creek. And we even debated whether or not we'd need a car because we said, oh, if it's a village, we can just walk to the shops. No. Thank God we got a car because we would have been absolutely stuffed without one.
Can't even build a village.
It's not a village. Whatever that was, it was gorgeous, don't get me wrong, but it was not a village. It was just all spread out. Everything was just so spread out. It was very nice. It was very open. You felt very, but yeah, you definitely needed a car. Anyway, that was besides the point. So with all this global expansion, and with all these other nations kind of jumping on the bandwagon and they're all getting into manufacturing, they need a lot more raw materials and new markets. So in no time, we're exporting cotton from India, for example, sugar from the Caribbean, tea from everywhere else. We've now got plenty of steamships and railways to move everything and everyone around. So the increase in global trade is absolutely huge. And the not so fun part is that all this industrial power did go to people's heads a little bit, and empires, particularly the British Empire, did become a bit greedy. And we, well, one of the topics we did recently, you kind of touched on this subject. The European powers, that they pretty much carved up Africa and Asia. They called it civilization, but really they just wanted their resources and markets. And colonized countries like India and China, they were stripped of their raw materials and just turned into producers of cheap goods with all the profits flying back to Europe. So we've gone from exploiting our own children in factories to exploiting other nations. So lovely lot, aren't we?
What past tense, I think, might have been, yeah. I'm not taking the blame for something that happened 200 years ago.
No, but it was your ancestors. So you should be
No.
responsible. You should be held responsible for
No.
your ancestors
Oh,
because their DNA is in you. All right. So essentially, it's your fault. End of.
Bear in mind, we're all related, so everyone should be taking the blame then. But then, where I've done my family tree, none of mine were involved in any of that.
Were they not? I'm sure they were.
No.
They just didn't tell you about it.
But unless they left one little town,
One of them would
British
have
census records.
snuck out, pretty sure of that.
No, I've not seen the money then.
No. So talking about Britain exploiting other countries. No, I'm lost. I forgot what I was talking about. Exploitation. I'm exploiting myself now because I don't know what I'm talking about. Factories needing cheap labour, that's what I was going to talk about. So you've got your factories needing cheap labour, you've got your mines needing strong backs, your plantations needing workers, millions were moved to industrial centres or transported as indentured labourers or worse. We won't go into that.
Yeah.
Working class conditions were very grim worldwide, with long hours, low pay, and a very high risk of death by machinery. But on the plus side, when the labour movements and unions did form in response, it went across the border too. It wasn't just isolated to England. And we've already talked about deforestation and polluted rivers and skies. This wasn't just a British problem, it went global. So it did reshape the world, but maybe not entirely in a good way. But overall, the conclusion, we're nearly at the end. Yay! The Industrial Revolution was a turning point, and it transformed Britain into the world's first, so we did it first, the world's first industrial superpower, boosting the economy, expanding its cities, and creating a whole new class of people, the middle class. But the rapid progress did come at a cost. So pollution, poor working conditions, and widening inequality, and not to mention the exploitation and disruption in colonised countries abroad.
Yeah.
Swings and roundabouts. But yeah, it did very much uproot the traditional ways of life. But in short, it reshaped everything. It reshaped how people worked and lived, but not just that, how the entire world functioned. And it left a legacy that is still shaping our modern age. So it was huge. It was big. And that was a very long chat. So, and I'm well done for listening to that, because I did go on a bit. I apologise.
Yeah, I've said it many times.
Yeah,
but I've pointed out several times through that how things haven't changed. It's obviously down to the Industrial Revolution and the fact that we are slow to learn at times.
Mm-hmm. We are. And
it makes a good award-winning podcast.
That was. I should definitely get at least one award for that. Maybe two.
Do they do podcasts at the Oscars, or is that just movies?
No, I think they do podcasts now. Particularly podcasts that put people to sleep. You get awards for that. So I'll definitely nominate myself for that one.
Ready.
Yeah.
You get your speech ready.
I will. A sleep-inducing speech.
Hey,
yes, I've finished. I can open my window in a minute because it's too freaking
hot. Yeah, that's exactly what I'll be doing.
But anyway, I'll let you do the round off thing, because that's you. Yeah, go on, you do that.
Yeah, thank you for putting up with another one of our episodes from the We're Not Expert History podcast.
If you're still awake.
We are not experts. We're just two people with too much time on their hands.
If you enjoyed our podcast, please leave us a nice rating or positive review on whichever platform you use. You can also find us on Instagram by searching for We're Not Experts Podcast, where you will find a link to our webpage, wnehpodcast.wixsite.com/amateurs.